From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Shuddering sighs of relief today in the Washington area and around the country. Police arrested a man and teenager in connection with the sniper shootings that have left 10 people dead, 3 wounded, and a nation glued to its almighty media. In this hour, murders, media, and the information age. We begin with the very latest developments from Washington. Gail Shattuck is with the Christian Science Monitor and has been covering the sniper case. Good evening and welcome, Gail.
Good evening.
What have we learned today?
Listen, 2 minutes ago, this area heard the greatest sentence we've heard in a long time, that the weapons seized from the vehicle last night are forensically determined to be the same weapon responsible for these killings.
So this is it. This is the sniper and accomplice, or
this
two snipers.
This is the sniper and accomplice, exactly.
Wow.
The gun was the key thing, and that people were on bated breath to see first if they would find it, and most importantly, if there would be a match.
Who delivered this confirming news?
Agent Bouchard of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. He's been here ever since this investigation began, as all the federal agents have, in the background, some say actually running the investigation, but a very important and massive mobilization in this area.
Was Police Chief Moose there?
Absolutely he was. He's really come to represent this investigation. He's local. People know him. He has great ties with the community. And this has been quite an ordeal that I think no other police chief in the country has ever gone through anything quite like this.
We all saw or heard about him snapping a couple of weeks ago when the famous tarot card was put in the hands of the media. What's the report card on his handling of the case, or fronting for the handling of the case, in the days since?
You know, he's come under a tremendous amount of criticism, but as County Executive Duncan told me yesterday, had he done things 180 degrees differently and there was still no capture, there would be the same level of criticism. I think the fact that there was a capture will ease a lot of that. But still, I think the really important question, and this is going to be studied for years, what did he know? When did he know it? How much could he have shared with the public? Now, how much of the threat, how much of information about the suspects? This is really going to be debated for years.
Are you suggesting, Gail, that in spite of his anger and upset at what was revealed, that there was a lot more that might have come out that did not?
Oh, yes. On all sides. They knew things that weren't revealed to the public or the press. The press knew things that wasn't revealed to the public, incredibly, for all the leaks. It was really a balance on all sides.
What did the press know that wasn't revealed, Gail?
Well, I think,
can you
for
say?
Example, the timing of the revealing of the names of these suspects. AP had it much earlier than the television station that revealed it. But, you know, I think from the beginning, after that initial leak, when people began to realize that when you went on air and said something like, the killer never moves beyond his comfort zone, and then he immediately kills someone beyond the comfort zone, or you say, he doesn't, you know, the children are safe, and the next day a child is killed, people be in the media and, you know, in law enforcement began to realize that what they said had consequences and people would die.
That there was a feedback loop here. The killer was acting on what he heard.
Yes, and I think even though there was a lot of leaking in this story, and to my mind, a lot of irresponsible leaking, there was a lot of things that could have been said that were not.
Gail Shattuck, what are the most important things that we know tonight about John Allen Muhammad and John Lee Malvo?
We know that they had in their possession a gun responsible for 13 shootings in this area, and that is the absolute key thing we need to know. After that, there'll be a lot of questions of motivation, to my mind, important questions of whether they acted alone, and I think the larger issue, how could it be that arguably one of the best defended cities in the world, with resources in this investigation going all the way to the Pentagon, could have been reduced to the state that it was by 13 bullets from two men who frankly don't seem all that bright?
Yeah, it's kind of a frightening example, and we're already hearing the feedback this last week from Hezbollah in the Middle East saying, look, one shooter in Washington has brought America to a standstill.
Yes. I would say to Hezbollah and to anyone else watching this, it's also been a very powerful object lesson. The police learned, too. You know, we talk about homeland defense and all these assurances that we're ready. Well, we're not. And I think everyone involved in this investigation began to realize what it's going to take to really get this country on a footing to face something more serious than two guys who could shoot straight but not much else.
Mm-hmm. Gail, I just want to speak directly to one issue. Is there anything that's been said today by law enforcement that would indicate any kind of terrorist link between these two arrested men? Is there any terrorism envelope here?
Not yet. This is something that, you know, a lot of experts have looked at very closely. I think you're going to see a lot of research in the next few weeks into, for example, a Camden connection, into, you know, connections in training camps. These men are going to be tracked, you know, practically hour by hour for the last few years,
mm-hmm.
and every contact will be looked at closely. But I think the point you raised earlier is just as important. What lesson has this experience given to real terrorists? What will they learn from it, and what may we have to deal with as a result of it?
And the question we're grappling with tonight, Gail, you've been in the eye of this hurricane. How do you judge the performance of the media in the whole three-week saga of the sniper?
I take a pretty sad look at the media, especially how we handle the whole question of speculation. I mean, one of the things that experts on serial killers told all of us early on is that these people are obsessed with their own self-importance and do pay attention to what's said about them. And I think if you look back at some of the people that the press first started and television picked up, claiming to be, for example, FBI profilers when their credentials aren't quite that elevated,
mm-hmm.
making very extravagant claims, and politicians, frankly, making very, you know, fighting statements that, of course, the public can identify with. I think there's no one that couldn't think of the harshest terms imaginable for these men. But you don't say them out loud in the middle of an investigation, however good it makes you or the people that hear you hear it. The important thing is capturing the criminals and ending the violence.
Well,
and there I think the media has a lot of careful looking to do. Did all the leaking we do, was it necessary, or was it just promoting ourselves?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly the loop we're looking at tonight. Gail Shattuck, thanks for coming on and giving us the latest that the weapon in possession of the two men arrested today is the weapon that was behind the shootings over the last 3 weeks. Thank heavens, it sounds as though we are finished with that. Gail Shattuck, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Gail Shattuck is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke to us from Bethesda, Maryland. We're talking tonight about the wall-to-wall coverage of the Washington sniper case. With 10 people killed and 3 more wounded over just 3 weeks, it has been the big, gripping story. And in American media today, big, gripping stories get supersized treatment around the clock to our eyes, to our ears, to our front stoops, our computers, our central nervous systems. Saddam who? It was the sniper's next move that kept a nation glued to the tube. Media, armed with its arsenal of satellite technology, brought us every step of the investigation, or most of it, we now learn, even the false steps, and the ones police desperately wanted untold. Did the media help or hurt in this case? Are there some things the media just should not report? And does our supercharged media mania turn the news industry into a global showcase for criminals, a megaphone for killers? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Chris Hansen, professor of journalism at the University of Maryland and a 20-year print journalist veteran. Good evening and welcome, Chris Hansen.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Hi.
Chris Hansen, we're looking out across this landscape tonight. We all by now know how the American media can rev up its mighty engines these days, and we've seen it again and again since The Girl in the Well, since O.J., since Chandra Levy. I mean, you name it, fill in the blanks. This time, the kind of drumbeat getting America's attention was I suppose, just about as riveting as it could be, that day after day of innocent civilians, suburbans, being shot out of nowhere and killed. When you look at the way the media handled this case, how do you judge the treatment?
I would say that in the coverage of the actual news, I would give media maybe a B plus. Didn't do that badly. That was one of their problems. Was that, however, is that they had to fill a lot of time when there was no news, particularly TV. That's where they did very badly, I think.
What do you mean by they had to fill a lot of time? Who compelled them to fill that time?
The good point. The way to put it is that when TV discovers that their ratings pick up when they're on a story and their ratings drop when they're off it, which was the case here, then the bottom line dictates that they're going to stay on that story. So if they're going to do it, what do they do? So they bring in a bunch of experts who state contradictory things over and over and over and over, and cause no enlightenment for the public at all.
And that's where the rolling news never ends. What about on the point of the criminal investigation and the media? We heard police chief Moose a couple of weeks ago just literally begging the media not to reveal the kinds of things that revealed with I Am God and the tarot card. But what's your assessment of whether or not the media actually impeded the investigation? Could a case even be made that the media paved the way for more killings?
Yeah, two very good questions. One, did they impede the investigation? We don't know yet, because the debriefing of these suspects might give us some more insight into that. But I don't know of any evidence at the moment that the media, in and of themselves, acting independently from the police, impeded the investigation at all. The things that Chief Moose was objecting to, the revelation of the tarot card message, that information came from police. I talked to the reporter who broke the story, and he said that some of the police sources who confirmed the story for him said that they thought it would be a good idea to have that information out there, because someone in the public might use the tarot card clue and identify someone who they otherwise might not have thought of as a possible suspect. You know, the guy upstairs with the tarot card on his door. Other leaks, such as the leak about the threat to the children on the note down in Ashland, Virginia.
And was that a leak?
I believe it was initially a leak. And then Chief Moose came back later after a considerable period of time and finally confirmed it and read the exact statement. But there was a period there when obviously there was disagreement between police as to whether that information should be out. So it came out first through media down in near Richmond, and then later was officially confirmed. The police were obviously at odds there as to when and if that information should be put out.
Jack Beatty, join us here. It is clearly moving into a kind of new world when the media gets going these days. It is so pervasive that an investigation, a killing spree, anything that comes into the eye of that national attention is inevitably shaped by the observation.
Yes, it is. You know, you can almost see it having three functions. It functions, the media does, as a lamp, as a mirror, and as a carrier. As a lamp, it lights up facts, and we heard about the facts, and there may even be a sense in which the people in the final tip to get the killers came from facts revealed through television. But on the other hand, it functions as a mirror. In it, the killers can see themselves empowered and magnified, and copyists can see how this can happen, and even terrorists. I mean, it was Don Rumsfeld to say that terrorists go to school on us. And thirdly, the media functions as a carrier. It carries the experience of fear to us. That's what it's all about. That's what the obsessive thing does to you. You're sitting there, you're thinking, I'm not safe. Well, what does that do? Well, it creates in you what some people call a kind of mean world syndrome. And that goes along with a heightened withdrawal from the public. In fact, there was a quote from a woman in Maryland said, I'm not going to vote. It's too dangerous. Of course, if she doesn't vote, that means NRA people are way overrepresented in the electorate. And the long-term solution, sane gun control, can't emerge.
There's that gun in your pocket, Jack. We're talking tonight about law enforcement in the information age, media, and murderers. When a murderer is on the loose, does the media help or hurt? Is there anything the media should not report? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about murders, the media, and the information age. Today, police arrested two men suspected of killing 10, wounding three civilians in the Washington, D.C. area over the last 3.5 weeks. Here, from just a few minutes ago, is Montgomery County, Maryland, is County Executive Doug Duncan speaking at a press conference just minutes ago.
People in the Washington metropolitan region are breathing a collective sigh of relief hearing the news that was just announced in relation to this case. This task force worked together in an unprecedented and remarkable fashion. So on behalf of this community, I want to say thank you to all the members of the task force. I also want to thank the people of this region. Throughout this horrible ordeal, the residents of this community proved that faith and hope always triumphs over darkness and despair. We continued to go about our lives, caring for our neighbors, educating our children, reaching out to help others, and providing comfort to the victims' families, while at the same time calling the tip line and contributing to the reward fund.
That was Montgomery County, Maryland County Executive Doug Duncan. Just a few moments ago at a press conference, we're talking about law enforcement in the information age tonight, about media and murders. Is there anything the media should not report? Would you have reported the tarot card? Would you feel safer if information were withheld? And is there just too much volume of coverage of criminals? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Chris Hansen. He's a 20-year print journalist and professor at the University of Maryland School of Journalism. We're joined now by Edward Tully. He's joining us from Fredericksburg, Virginia. He was with the FBI for 31 years, teaching federal investigators how to deal with the media. Good evening and welcome, Edward Tully.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Edward Tully, when you look back across these 3 weeks and across your 30 years of experience talking with investigators about how to deal with the media, what do you see? Was this a case where the media interfered? Were they postponed a successful outcome to the investigation, or where they were helpful?
Well, on balance, Tom, I thought the media did a very, very good job. They fulfilled their role that they have in our society, both as a watchdog and as a carrier of information to the public. There may have been a little bit of excess media exposure in the cable television shows, but on balance, I think both the print media and the electronic media did a fine job.
When you see the apparent kind of feedback loop between media and, in this case, killer, that Chris Hansen and Jack Beatty have both spoken to, when a killer may be watching the media, learning, responding, changing behavior in response to what he sees there, is there any way of getting around that in an era as soaked in media as the one we live in now?
I do not believe there is. It's a price that we pay for the free press. I don't know how it could be avoided in any way. And I'm not sure that it should be.
And what does it mean for law enforcement then, Edward Tully, when we all kind of share a neural network practically at this point through media that's just everywhere? Does it change the way investigators, law enforcement officials have to go about their work, working in a fully wired up, information-loaded world?
Oh, it makes a significant difference in the way that law enforcement has to work, Tom. It makes it a lot more difficult. Doesn't make it impossible, but there are some positive advantages to it. The tip line, for example, that led to the arrest of these two gentlemen is an example of how the media played a significant role in this particular case. There's no question that the media is on a dangerous, slippery slope here. It's a media problem, and more so than a law enforcement problem, in that the media may be on the verge of becoming a player in this drama as opposed to an observer. And I'm not sure that the media needs to take that role, but that is something that I'd have to leave up to the professional expertise of people in the media rather rather than, you know, express my opinion on it.
Well, I guess that is the question, though, whether the media even has a choice at this point, given how it is wired into almost everything going on. Can it avoid being an actor? Jack Beatty, you raised that just before the break, but what's your sense? Is the media now an actor, a shaper, an integral factor of the news, of all news?
Well, I think it is. I think there are good examples of that, such as in this case, and then if you take the Jewell case or the Condit case, two other recent cases, the media frenzy caused a great deal of pain and hardship in those both of those cases. They reported a lot of erroneous information, rumor, innuendo, etc.
And which came from police sources.
Chris Hansen, you're saying much came from police sources. What do you make of that, Edward Tully?
I think he's correct. I think a lot of it comes from police sources, perhaps not official police sources, however. And it could come from other sources as well. But when you're on that slope, as I think media is, or at least the electronic and print media are, I think they have to be very, very careful that they don't overstep their charter, so to speak.
Chris Hansen, and yet you wrote in the Baltimore Sun that Chief Moose hit the wrong target when he lashed out at the media. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I meant there was that the chief was frustrated because this information about the tarot card had come out, and so he lashed out at the press. He was also obviously very, very irritated that it had obviously come from police in some other jurisdiction. So, I mean, the police need to get their act together, because in order to have a prayer of getting reported to withhold information, the authorities have to make a compelling case that releasing it will jeopardize the investigation. And if the police aren't speaking with one voice, it's very hard to make that case. Another area where I think the police need to make a stronger case is situations where, like in these dragnet situations, like on Tuesday, where after the bus driver was shot, the police were asking that live shots that showed where the dragnet was going, where cars were being stopped, and also these from helicopter and also from these stationary traffic cameras be curtailed. And by and large, they were, but there were some cases where some of the stations actually showed some of the live footage. If you're going to try to control that kind of live coverage, it seems to me that you have to make a concerted effort and do a lot of planning in advance. And I think it's very serious to bring about a dialogue between media and police, especially if there's now a danger of terrorists coming in and copycatting this, that there needs to be some self-restraint on the part of reporters who can beam out a live shot and actually tip off perpetrators who might be watching to escape or to reposition themselves to shoot again.
And yet, Jack Beatty, historically, the American media's mission has been to use whatever means are at their disposal to get out the news of what's going on.
Yes, that's a commercial imperative, too, as Gail Shattuck reminded us.
But not only that, also a principled imperative of the news business, at least as we've understood it.
That's true, but I don't think you can. If you watch CNN, as I have, you can't but miss the effort to aestheticize this. Forever this talking about the story. The story is getting more dramatic as we're watching it. Stay tuned. It's not a story. It's a horrible mass murder. The whole tone of these incessant mirroring that's going on is aesthetic. It's about the story and keeping you tuned in, and the effect on that, really, I think, is to kind of, well, I don't know, if I were the loved one of someone who was killed by these murderers, I think I would just be disgusted with these media people, Wilf Blitzer and Aaron Brown and the rest of them, saying, well, what else have you got for us? I mean, I understand they have to do their job, but here, there, it's the whole sort of our response to this becomes the media response. It's the story. And yeah. All I can remember is how the Kennedy assassination was carried. I mean, Walter Cronkite took off his glasses and rubbed his eye, And for the rest of it was completely sober. No talk about story or let's keep the story going. We have something new here going on, and morally and politically, it's disturbing.
Yeah, I think the problem is not so much that it's not a story; it's that it is in a sense a story at the same time that it's a tragedy. And where these excesses and grotesque trivialization comes in is when there's a lapse in information. There's a compulsion to tell a story. These organizations are trying to draw an audience to tell a story. And then they don't have anything to tell, and so then they fill it up with hype, and it basically numbs us out and distances us from what is a terrible, terrible human tragedy.
It feels like we're riding the technology here, or being ridden by it. The tube is on, the radio is on, the computer is on, and something's going to be pumped out over that. I want to welcome into our conversation now Bob Zelnick. He's chair of the journalism department at Boston University, spent 21 years in the news business, including a long time with ABC News. Bob Zelnick, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good to be with you.
Bob Zelnick, I think you've heard a little bit of this conversation, but we're trying to get at how this completely wired kind of neural network of news changes our society around crime, potentially even around terror. Do you see the news media acting responsibly? Is that the right question to ask?
Well, there's so many news media. I think that for the most part, most of the electronic and print media played the story responsibly. Mm-hmm. I do agree that when you're on around the clock, treating this as there is no other story on earth, and looking for new developments when there are none, and you end up interviewing the same experts and cycling them one after the other, each speculating as to who the killer is and what his motivation is, what his mood is, whether he's watching the coverage. I think you're doing a disservice because you are essentially departing from the essential mission of news media, and that is to report the truth fairly, accurately, and promptly. And what you're doing is essentially inventing an awful lot of non-news to fill in the gaps.
But isn't the media at this point quite clearly something more than simply a news media? It is also a nonstop conversation with ourselves.
Well, I think that's true, but we ought to be very, very wary about the content of that conversation. And we ought to be very wary about what we're holding out that conversation to be. If we're telling people to stay abreast because there are new developments, or suggesting that there is a breaking story and there is no news for hours on end except the generated hype and speculation of so-called experts, I don't think that we're performing a public service there. Now, I do think that there is another dimension to the question, and that is when the media is used as a messenger to carry information from the police to the suspect or from the suspect to the police. And that takes me back to my own days covering the Middle East, when there was a great deal of terrorism and where the terrorists used the news media to internationalize their message and to gain credibility and stature in the debate of the moment, and that is yet another story.
That participation by both sides, carrying messages by both sides. Bob Zelnick, I know we have to let you go, but thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Bob Zelnick is chair of the journalism department at Boston University. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Nicole is on the line. Welcome, Nicole. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment about the media. I personally am in federal law enforcement, and I was really, specifically speaking about the 24-hour news stations, was very disappointed in some of the coverage. I thought it was extremely excessive. They second-guessed the police at every move, and they're not police. They're not lawyers, and I felt they really took advantage of that situation, and they really had nothing to report.
Nicole, you're in law enforcement yourself.
Yes.
Did what you see appear to constitute a hindrance to an investigation?
I think at some points, I'm not sure if necessarily it hindered it, but I think the misinformation that was purposely put out, even when law enforcement was correcting it, saying that is inaccurate, and they would continue to put out misinformation. And I think that could be a problem. I think only time will tell whether or not it actually did. But I do think it's a disservice to the public. If they're supposed to be reporting the truth and the news, well, where is that if they're just, you know, making things up or reporting things they know to be false?
Nicole, let me put that to Chris Hansen. Chris, on the other hand, we got a lot of information out that people wanted to hear. Lives were in danger. People were living in a what felt like a free fire zone sometimes. It's also the news media's job to get out the information they can get their hands on, isn't it?
That's correct. And information that is reported by these reporters tends to be from official sources, but speaking, on a not-for-attribution basis, because there's disagreement as to what information should come out. I'm unaware of reporters making up factual information and deliberately putting out misinformation. I think that what happens is that we just don't know what the real problem is that neither the police nor the media knew how these perpetrators would react to information. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, information that the police put out might have contributed to tunnel vision on the part of citizens. In other words, the white truck and the...
Right, that was all over the front pages.
Yeah. and then also the notion that these killers were probably angry white males. Mm-hmm. There was a disturbing report in the Post today that the car that the perpetrators were in their car, Baltimore police found them shortly after the time when the child was hit in Boy, Maryland, mm-hmm. and questioned them and released them, and they said that it was because the car didn't fit the pattern and because the race didn't fit the presumption.
You mean that the two men who were arrested today were actually briefly held earlier?
They weren't held. They were just according to this report in the Post, the police talked to them, mm-hmm. and then they were sent on their way.
So there's the danger of television. Oh, I mean, tunnel vision. Nicole, thank you for your call. Edward Tully, what about it? Is there a new regime that has to come in here in terms of how police interact with the media? Is it possible to tighten up the information flow, or should it even be tightened up?
Tom, there are about three points that I could just touch on briefly. Number one. Dr. Martin referred to the case in Baltimore where they stopped them on October 8th, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. A nice case of reverse discrimination, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and a reverse.
You're black, not white. We're looking for white men off your go.
That's right. Mr. Zelnick made an outstanding point when he talked about terrorism and their capturing of the media. And in the future, should this happen in the United States, say a similar case to this one, but one that does involve terrorism, the role of the media will come under intense microscope.
We're going to come back and talk about that, Edward Tully. We're talking tonight about media and murders. Is this mass murder as showbiz? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight on the day when two men have been arrested and the rifle in their possession is the rifle, we're told, that the shooter used, on the day when the sniper apparently has been captured in the Washington area, about law enforcement in the information age, about media and murderers. My guests tonight are Chris Hansen. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland and a longtime print journalist himself. And Edward Tully, who for 31 years was with the FBI teaching federal investigators how to deal with the media. You can join us as well. Does media mania turn our news industry into a showcase for criminals, a megaphone for killers and terrorists? Is there any alternative in this fully wired age we live in? Was the media overboard with the Washington sniper, or did it give you just what you needed? Are you informed by or a little ashamed of your own immersion in the sniper story? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Edward Tully, you were saying just before the break, and I want to come back to it, that if and when There is another terrorist attack in the United States. The media, of course, will pick it up. But you're fearing. Well, what is it you're fearing there?
Well, if the media carries the message, as they did of these killers, in regard to their cause, to the extent that we have seen on cable television, perhaps to an excess, I think we've got a real problem with the media, and it's going to cause a law enforcement response that is probably necessary, and that is law enforcement is going to have to become a lot more disciplined in the amount of information that they unofficially release.
Mm-hmm. We've already seen that in the U.S. military in the last decade. They've tightened up enormously.
They have, and I'm not sure that's the best thing for the American public to do.
Well, we want a free press, and we need a free press, and we need the information, but we've got a whole new technology and a whole new volume here. Alex is on the line. Welcome, Alex. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Doing a great job. You certainly whipped up a boiling cauldron this evening. I wanted to say there's an awful lot of it's such a huge subject, but, you know, this TV has been on a slippery slope forever, okay? This is not something new. Serial killers watch television. Obviously, you know, what was said by, a couple of your guests is, you know, I completely agree with. You know, it's a terrible situation, and sometimes it is trivialized, but that is the price we pay. We got to have it. Mm. You're going to maybe make it non-commercial? When's that going to happen? It's not too likely. Mm-hmm. And maybe it all can't be NPR, although maybe that would be a good thing.
But when you say we've got to have it, what is the it that we've got to have in your mind, Alex? What
we've
exactly?
We've got to have people out there who are attempting to bring us the news. Mm.
Absolutely.
And you know, in spite of all the excess, which is brought on because they have a vested interest in making money, mm-hmm. you know, which they have to do, mm-hmm. It's still, as ugly as it might get sometimes and as stupid as it does get sometimes, we need to have it.
We do. We're going to stand up for the free press here, Alex, here tonight and always. And thank you for your call. But at the same time, we've got a difference in magnitude, a difference in omnipresence. Chris Hansen, does that somehow change the name of the game here? Does it change the dynamic? Does it put a different imprint on society, on civilization, to have everything mirrored back to us, magnified back to us so quickly, so pervasively?
I think it absolutely does. In a sense, it changes the whole quality of life. And when one is tuning into the periods in between the actual news where this endless bloviating goes on, I think that it really detaches us from something that is important and trivializes it. It also, I mean, there is the argument that perpetrators like these folks who've been caught are driven by the desire for publicity, and some people actually went so far as to argue in this case that the media were inadvertently aiding and abetting additional killings.
By giving so much attention.
Yeah, and that's possible. We don't really know enough yet about the suspects. There are other profiles that it was thought that they might be terrorists, that they might be doing it because they simply enjoy killing and outwitting police, that they were simply insane on some level where they didn't have rational motivations.
So we've got to have the coverage, but at some level, are we sort of handing the global media microphone over to whatever Lex Luthor steps up and sheds blood?
Well, it certainly appears that way. I mean, the alternative is to cover some other news and to do some actual reporting rather than just, you know, repeat the same stuff mm-hmm. over and over. The problem there is the bottom line, that if the ratings are there for having this story on, then these commercial operations are really going to listen mainly to that. And so the only way to push something like this into perspective would be if something else that's horrible comes along that is threatening enough to our audience that, you know, that it impedes. In other words, if we were closer to a war with Iraq, then that would take up some of it. One thing that certainly didn't seem to to edge out the sniper story at all is the coming election.
Election and a whole laundry list of other issues that may be of far greater ultimate import for this society, for the world. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. I want to invite them in. Jason is on the line. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
As a viewer, I find the whole situation very confusing.
How so?
I feel as though I'm participating in this voyeuristic community of ours by, you know, being one of these people that goes to the television and turns it on every couple hours to see what's going on.
It's hard to pull away from.
It's very hard to pull away from. I think it's particularly confusing for myself because I'm a television photographer as well, so I'm sort of participating in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding my only way out is just to turn the television off at times. But it's definitely confusing as a viewer.
Yeah, we feel it, Jason, and thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, I don't know if this is our top literary reference, but my children have had Harry Potter all over, and Harry Potter has got a mirror that if you stare into and you become so absorbed in it that you float away from what really needs doing. We want to think of the press as the thing that alerts us to what needs attention, but what if it doesn't?
Well, Tom, this is Ed Tully.
Ed Tully.
I don't think I'd want to exaggerate this case too much, and maybe we are.
All right.
It was a highly unusual case in a very media-intense climate. And
on the doorstep of the nation's capital.
Right, and I'm not sure that we're going to have a whole lot more like it. But
well, that I wonder about, Ed.
I think it may be a problem that will self-correct.
Mm-hmm.
On both sides. There are honorable people on both sides, and I think we can make adjustments to it. We certainly will learn from our mistakes in this case, and hopefully the media will as well.
Jack, what's your sense here? We have come through a decade with quite a list of uber super media obsession from O.J. through Chandra Levy and up to Columbine and all the rest. Is this a permanent fixture that we're always in the thrall of some story, or do you think, as Tully suggests, that this one was uniquely kind of menacing and obsessing?
No, I think it's part of a continuity. You know, I think that after increases in quantity can yield differences in kind, and I think that's what's happened with cable television now. As Jason said, we plug it in. There it is. And it's like a low-grade civic infection. That's how I would look at it. Fear, fear, fear. You know, studies have shown that reactions to the 11 o'clock news, which are, if it bleeds, it leads, is the criterion, actually have harmed economies. The city of Baltimore did a study. Their economy was being hurt by the news.
Mm.
Well, this is going on all the time. Because CNN exists, we can plug it in and get our daily dose of what they think is the most supreme story in the world, whether it's, and it always involves mass violence, you know, sensationalism of one kind or other. Would they ever do, you know, 5 hours on medical lack of health insurance? I mean, never. There's
Don't hold your breath, Jack. You might need medical attention. Mark
right.
is calling from Williamsville, New York. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Thanks. I think we need to start this conversation by talking about the Constitution. I always say that I don't believe in an adversarial press. I believe in a belligerent press. And I think that the alternative to the media overcovering might be the media undercovering, and that would be far, far worse.
No question about it. But what about Jack Beatty's observation, Mark, that at some point volume changes the quality, the very character of anything that goes to massive volume?
I mean, we've
got to have a free press. It's right there. Absolutely. But can we be so drenched in an obsessive kind of press work that things get warped?
I think the reason that we have this kind of thing is because we have a bunch of media outlets all competing to report the same story and tell the same things. And that is because the media has become so consolidated in this country and so controlled by so few corporations. I think that if there were more access to different viewpoints, then you would have channels and stations and magazines and so forth covering from different angles and different ways and different viewpoints, and it wouldn't be just this continual upping of the volume to tell the same thing more loudly to get more eyes on your screen. Mm-hmm. It would be much better for democracy that way. It would be more voices.
We're all for the voices, Mark, and thank you for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Chris Hansen, where do you see the way out of the overkill, or was this overkill in your view? Do you agree with Ed Tully that this was about what's required when a sniper is loose on the edges of the nation's capital?
I think that reporting the story as it developed, and facts as they were verified, that was done reasonably well. Mm-hmm. Our last caller was suggesting that you need this overkill, and the problem is that the overkill really did not consist of advancing the story, advancing our understanding of it, or helping us figure out things to do to make it safer. It was just the din of the experts and so on. And one point though is that there is a choice. You can go online and you can go and find out all kinds of information about other stories. You could listen to public radio, which did not overdo this story. Mm-hmm. It kept a remarkable balance.
Though it paid plenty of attention to it. We had two evenings on this show, and you've heard plenty on NPR.
Yeah, but you did not overdo it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you listen to the broadcasts of the news, there was a considerable balance in what they presented. You have access to the BBC television, and you can watch that. And they have a different mix. To some extent, the problem is not the media entirely. It's also the viewer. You have the choice, and the reason why the media keeps staying on the thing is because of the ratings, and the ratings come from who's watching.
Let's get one more call. Marnie's on the line. Hi, Marnie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I think that you just alluded to something that I've been thinking about, mm-hmm. and that is that I don't feel that the audience is that separate from the media, and I really believe that the media is driven by the audience. I feel that personally, that I wonder if it's not, if it wouldn't be important to examine what is the draw for all of us, the compulsion to turn on that television. I think it's more than just I think there's some value in keeping us safe and knowing what's going on, but I think that there's something above and beyond that is worth looking into.
Well, that goes right to the heart of it, Marnie, and our time's running down, so forgive me, but I thank you for your call. Jack Beatty, I mean, sex, fear, death, these are almost in the genes. It is hard for humans to look away from some subjects.
Yeah, it's a case of permissive exploitation, isn't it? We permit them to exploit us because we're fascinated by this kind of thing. And, I really think the history of American boredom plays a role here, too. I mean, these things are punctuations of our lives. We get a little, spurt of energy and interest by plugging in, and suddenly we're part of a national experience. And I think people crave that. If only there could be, what should I say, more edifying national experiences. Mm. But I think I think Marnie is absolutely right. I mean, you show an accident, people, the famous instance of Burke is you can have Shakespeare on the stage and someone will yell, there's a fire down the street, and the theater will empty to see the fire.
And yet there's two sides to that. If death is what we line up to see, it may be provided to us by criminals, by terrorists. It feels like we are indeed moving into a new dynamic. I want to thank you, Ed Tully, for being with us tonight. It's been great having you. Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
Edward Tully was with the FBI for 30 years, teaching federal investigators how to deal with the media. And Chris Hansen, professor of journalism at the University of Maryland, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Jack Beatty, there's a new vista. And I suppose this one will go and another story will show up. And will we... can we ever keep the right balance?
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Well, or maybe shut it off once in a while.
Yes.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. If you choose, log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.